all bad things. Tragedy.
Tragedies, disasters. Bad things.
Trigger warning for everything possible.
What?
I don't know if I can pull this off. I'll try it, but I may have to restart it.
Right. Okay.
It didn't come out exactly the way I planned, but I'm Rachel.
I'm David.
And this is All Bad Things.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome.
I don't think even make sense after we discuss the topic.
Is Alvin and the Chipmunks.
That was a good guess based on the topic. That was just, it came out so weird. It was not what I intended.
I think we should definitely leave that.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a good way to kick off 350.
Yes, that's right. Episode 350. We're over a third of the way to 1,000 episodes.
Yeah, we are. We probably, since we've lost like half our audience, we might not have, we might only have like 200 people.
At best.
Yeah, listening to us by then, but yeah. But anyway.
But follow us. Yes. Insta, X, Facebook, TikTok. For now, Twitch at All Bad Things Pod. Email us allbadthingspod@gmail.com. Join our Facebook discussion group and our Discord.
Do all of those things.
Our subreddit.
Yes.
Yeah.
All the things that we don't even do.
That's correct. That is correct.
You do them. Because you're our fans. You do them.
Our fans. I've never thought of our listeners as fans.
I guess I haven't either.
Yeah.
Just listeners,
friends.
Yeah, sure. Listeners. Yeah, friends.
Yes. Yeah, special shout out to Nicole who got us a very thoughtful
We are definitely going to have to share that on our discussion group page.
Yes, amongst absolutely. Other things. On Instagram.
Yes, that was an excellent gift. Thank you, Nicole.
Yes, a beautiful hand-painted portrait of a baby.
Jesse and Demetrius.
Probably the only time they will be portrayed
sitting next to each other without like hurting each
right.
other. Or mostly Jesse hurting Demetrius, but
primarily he is the oldest after all. We're both youngest children, so
we can relate to Demetrius.
So episode 350.
I know.
Kind of went with a deep cut here, because I got into like a little, because we did so many listener scripts, I got into like a, man, it's hard for me to churn out research. So to kind of get back into it and hopefully be a lot more consistent with conducting research, I was like, I need to do something that I'm going to like enjoy, mm-hmm. so to speak, mm-hmm. right? And so I was like, okay, something that I like to do very much is our episodes that involve musical clips, music
sure.
clips, right? So I am now going to sing what I was trying to do on the Hello that I did so poorly and see if you can name the band, okay?
Okay.
Ooh, wishing you were here. Do you know that song?
I don't. I mean, if I heard
How
the song.
How about this? Ooh, no, baby, please don't go. Dun, 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 dun.
Is it?
Do you know what band that is? Or what person that is singing?
Let me guess.
Okay.
But, is it Peter Cetera? Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, his voice is very...
Yes.
But I couldn't gotcha. Remember if it was him or if it was Chicago.
Bingo. It was Chicago.
I know what we're doing.
What are we doing?
I have a good idea of what we're doing. Okay. Does it involve the lead guitarist?
It does.
Yeah.
So you know this story?
I know. I just know it's happened.
Okay.
But yeah.
This is the story of the death of Terry Kath.
Yeah.
Yes.
Pretty brutal.
Do you know how he died?
I do, but I don't want to bring it up.
Yeah,
I just,
I'm going to leave
who
it
don't
for
know.
The end. Yeah.
Yes.
So on January 23rd, 1978.
I was a spry one year and 1 week old.
You were. You're 53 weeks old. Terry Kath, best known as the guitarist for the very well-known and boomer-beloved band Chicago, died at age 31.
At the time, the only band to where their debut album was a double album.
most of their first albums were double mm-hmm. albums. They did a ton of double
but albums. Until like recently, they were the only band ever to release for their first album. Mm-hmm.
You know a little more about Chicago than I would have thought, because I don't. You're not a huge Chicago fan, right?
I'm a fan of that era though, and they're heavily seminal. Involved in mm-hmm. that era. Mm-hmm. So
they sure are.
I mean, they have. I mean, I know they influenced Led Zeppelin and stuff like that, and they all these bands at that time influenced each other. Mm-hmm. Even country and pop were all kind of. I mean, you listen to country. Well, country's a little very redneck. I'll just say it. Like, you know, just kind of like not, but like Elvira type country music, not like pop country. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like Elvira is just a terrible song.
I don't know that song.
Apparently I loved it when I was 4 years old.
Okay.
And the Oak Ridge Boys.
Oh, okay.
And when we first started dating, we went over to somebody's house for karaoke.
Oh, Mark's,
and it was on there, mm-hmm. and I decided that's the song I'm going to sing, and hokey, that's the word I'm looking for.
Hokey.
Like, pre-1990s country is just hokey as fuck. I think it really is.
It depends on the artist, because, like, Dolly Parton did, Jolene is not hokey. That's Jolene's true. Jolene's a good song.
Yeah, you're
song.
Right, and there was still, like, Willie Nelson and stuff like that, mm-hmm. and yeah, so yeah, you're right.
Now, the Oak Ridge Boys.
Oak Ridge Boys.
Might be a different story.
They were definitely hokey as fuck.
Make a little bit.
But yeah, that's just an era that obviously we wouldn't have the stuff we had in the 90s without the 70s. Mm-hmm. So. Yeah.
So my primary sources were CNN, Far Out Magazine, Guitar World, Louder Sound, TerryKath.com, Chicago, The Terry Kath Experience, a documentary directed by Terry's daughter, Michelle Kath Sinclair, wow. and Wikipedia. Yeah, we'll talk more about her and about the documentary later, but... So I feel like this topic is a little bit of a deep cut, but Chicago was they were a huge band and they were very big in my house growing up. Sure. I still have the albums that my dad had when I was growing up.
Yeah, well, your dad plays saxophone, so it's
exactly.
Of course he loves and he's 60 plus, so of course he loves Chicago.
I was exactly going to say that. My dad is a boomer who plays baritone saxophone and loves rock music.
It's like if you met a 47-year-old guy and he really liked Nirvana. Like, very good chance of that. You know, mm-hmm. same thing with this.
Yes. My dad is also from Chicago originally, so right, he's kind of got a...
I always forget that, but yeah.
Yeah. He grew up in Miami, but yeah. At any rate, some of the earliest music I can remember, first of all, is Frankenstein by the Edgar Winters.
No, he's not such weird... such a weird take. Well, music is objective.
Coconut by Harry Nilsson.
But man, we'll put it this way, like, very much an alternative to what anybody else would be into.
Well, my dad's big into a lot of music.
Cheech and Chong?
Yes. Basketball Jones. Yeah. He's got a basket. Anyway, so Chicago, I know songs of theirs that I don't remember listening to.
I mean, I didn't realize, like, until I could play, like, an instrument, how good so many other bands were. And I remember hearing, like, Chicago's biggest song is probably, their biggest one is,
what do you think?
26 to
25, 6 to 4.
That's probably,
we're going to listen to some of that.
That's
later.
Probably, I would say that's an easy top three for
yes, them. Yeah, I would agree.
And it kind of makes you forget about, like, the Peter Cetera focused era because this is a rocking tune.
We are going to get into all of that. Yeah. So get ready to learn about Chicago, but
the band, not the city.
Yes, that's right. I don't remember if I mentioned this on the show before, but at my first grade talent show, my sister convinced me to wear I auditioned for this thing and I got in. I mean, the bar probably wasn't very high to be fair, but I wore my father's neon socks, neon necktie, and like a hat. And I danced and lip synced to Does Anybody Really Know What Time It Is? So I knew all the lyrics of Does Anybody Really Know What Time It Is by the time I was 6 or 7 years old. And I was performing. And since then, I have actually performed it by singing and playing bass. So mm-hmm. I've actually played several songs in my band. I currently sing 25 or 6 to 4, We're lucky that we have a...
Oh my God, that's right, mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're lucky that we have a very talented guitarist who can play a good approximation of the solo, yeah. But anyway, what I also found... I just wanted to do this for reference. So that was back in, like... When I was in first grade, it was, like, 1991, 92, right? So the equivalent of me lip-syncing to Does Anybody Really Know What Time It Is? That was a 22-year-old song at the time. Now it's 55 years.
Yeah.
It was the equivalent of a kid now getting up and lip-syncing Hot in Her.
So we're going back to O2.
Lose Yourself.
I was going to say, yep.
Or Skater Boy.
Yep. Those are all O2 songs.
Can you imagine a child dressing up in neon socks and tie and lip-syncing, it's getting hot in her.
If that was the outfit, that's what the song would have to be, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Start taking off the necktie and the socks. I did that. I actually...
So take off all your... Like, you couldn't fucking... Like, even if you lived on...
Is Shaggy?
No, it's... Nelly. Nelly.
That's right.
If you lived on the fucking moon, you still would have heard that song.
It's like the thong song. That was Cisco. Oh my God. Who was
in the... Previously in the group, the group from Baltimore, Drew Hill.
Oh, really?
Which is named after Druid Hill in Baltimore, which is like a...
I didn't know any of that. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, this topic is giving me...
There you go. If we have any Baltimore listeners.
It's giving me the opportunity to talk about music.
Yeah.
So get ready
for... Which we both love to talk about.
But get ready for copious amounts of Rachel's music corner here. Mm-hmm. So.
And copious amounts of me going off in my own music corner.
Well, there we go. Yeah. We'll go to our neutral corner. Yes.
We'll go to your corner.
Terry Allen Kath was born on January 31st, 1946, so he was actually like a week shy or so of turning 32 at the time. To Ray and Evelyn Kath. Unsurprisingly, he was born in Chicago, Illinois.
Oh,
really?
Oh, mm-hmm. No kidding.
Yeah, they're all from Chicago.
Well, that does make sense.
Yeah.
Were all the guys in Boston from Boston?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
So he was raised in Norwood Park in the northwest part of the city and had one older brother named Rod. Rod actually appeared in the documentary.
Okay.
Of Terry's daughter, yeah. I'm not going to go too far into Terry's childhood because, frankly, there's not much out there about it.
Well, I mean, if you're growing up in a city that large, like, it's really easy to...
Plus, also, you know.
There are countries that don't have the population of Chicago.
Right. And, you know, he was someone who wound up in one of the biggest American bands of the late 60s and 70s. Most of what's out there on him is less about him, more about his time in the band, right, or the band itself, right? It's worth noting that while Terry's family was quite musically inclined, his mother played the banjo, his brother played the drums... He learned music very informally. He was not formally musically trained.
And that seemed to be how it was back then. Like, I remember a friend of mine's dad talking about... Because when you and I were growing up, it was just like, people had instruments in their house. And that, for the most part, like, you knew somebody that played guitar. Or everybody knew somebody that played something.
Uh-huh.
But a friend of mine's dad was like, and we were just talking about it one night. He's like, yeah, that really didn't happen until, like, the Beatles came around. Like, for us. He's like, that's when people started. He's like, that's when music stores opened up and people were just...
It popularized the idea of playing an instrument.
Of just playing. Mm-hmm. You know?
That's interesting.
You know, so...
Yet another thing that the Beatles did.
Absolutely, and I'd never thought of it that way. Like, there was a time when... Or people like you learn music at church, things like that.
Yes, that's a long time. Especially a lot of gospel, well, not gospel artist stuff.
That's really one of the few reasons I'm like, yeah, I'm for the church. Like, leave all the
just
other...
Just the music. Just
show
the
up for
performance.
Fucking... Just show up for band practice.
A lot of black artists, especially back in the day. But even, like, I'm pretty sure, like, Beyonce started in church and shit.
Like Usher. Usher just did the Super Bowl. He's literally named... Usher, but him and who was the other? Is like Brandy the same way? Learned how to play and sing in church. And...
Gladys Knight, Aretha Franklin, like a lot of the greats got their starts in church too.
Yeah. That is like really like one of the only reasons I'm like, you can keep the churches.
It is one of the few positives about churches. I agree.
Like, they've got drum sets, most of them. You don't want a drum set guy.
But... So when Terry started playing electric guitar in the ninth grade, he learned entirely by ear, something that would continue throughout his life. Now, Rachel's Music Corner. Ding! For anyone who doesn't know what that means, to play, quote, by ear, that means that that person doesn't read music.
Right.
Right? So, depending, they may not even read tab or chords
I'm
or
sure
anything.
When he was growing up, there was no tablatures. Where were you going to get them?
Yes, there were. Yeah, you write them. People write them out.
No, but if you don't know how to.
Like, right. You'd have to be taught how to do it.
But
yeah.
Like when we were growing up, you had Guitar World magazine mm-hmm. that did all that for you. Had the tablatures.
Chad, I don't think Chad even reads chords.
Not officially. He can read tablatures.
Yeah, okay, tabs. That's how tabs would make sense.
That's how he grew up playing.
Because I remember one time I think I was jamming with him and I was telling him a chord and he's like,
he didn't
what?
Know. Yeah.
What are you talking about? But most musicians play by ear to some extent or another, right?
Yeah.
Listening to what you're playing is critical in music, obviously. The more you play, the more you can catch on, okay, this is where I go.
Well, like, when I first started playing the drums, there were like a couple songs I like had in my head for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know how to play the drums, so they were just stuck in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I kind of got competent, I'm like, I think I can play this. Like, and it's fun.
Right, yeah. But to have no reliance on written music is both its own kind of amazing thing and its own stumbling block in a way. It can make it tricky when other musicians are trying to talk about what is played. I say that as a musician who verbalizes music, right? I'm the person who says we're going to go verse, chorus, whatever. It's a 12-bar blues in A or... it's got a weird chord change here. It's a C to an F to an A flat, you know, and I'm talking about the actual, or like, it's not a triplet, it's a syncopated anticipation of the three.
All right, everybody's dropping off.
Well, anyway, no, I told you I was going to go on. I can read okay. I can play by ear okay. I don't do either brilliantly, but I do know the language of music. That got drilled into me. I've been to music school.
You've taken theory.
Yes. And sight singing.
Yeah.
So that is also good for the
ear.
That's
its own other world of competency.
And I'll tell you, it is a little tricky working with people who don't understand any of it. Because then you just have to be like,
Well, because you're like, how do I explain it to them?
You basically have to hum it and it's a little annoying. But anyway. So Terry joined his first, like, real band when he was 17, super common, especially back then.
So in 1963.
Yep, and fully in line with 1963, the band was called The Mystics.
Not a bad name.
Not terrible.
No, that's somewhat creative.
But I'm going to keep going. He then moved on to Jimmy Rice and The Gentlemen.
Yeah.
A couple
Mystics
years later.
Much better.
Then he played bass in Jimmy Ford and the Executives.
They were really hoping to get like a deal with like a local dealership.
Yeah, right.
Will you guys finance our tour, please? And give us a brand new Ford.
Yes. There are apparently a lot of Jimmys and their various gentlemen
right?
Ford members.
Yes.
Lots of Jimmys.
Jimmys was very popular back then.
Apparently pretty early on, even in some of these earlier bands, Terry emerged as the band leader. Like, he tended to kind of take lead when he was playing music.
Not uncommon for a lead guitarist.
Well, and I know from whence I speak that leading a band, fucking hard job. That's all I've got to say about that. Terry would later be remembered as someone who engaged in, quote, good-natured mischief. Kind of always up to something. By 1966, Terry had moved on to the band The Missing Links on bass. Along with friends Walter Perizzater and drummer Danny Serafine, both of whom had also been in Jimmy Ford's group. And Walter's friend...
they never got that forward.
Right. Walter's friend Lee Loughnane occasionally sat in with the band on trumpet. Walter, I didn't write this in here. Walter's the trombone player. So
okay,
they already
sure.
have a trombonist. Now a trumpet player is sitting in occasionally. A lot of the guys who moved in and out of groups that Terry was in were music students at DePaul University in Chicago. Terry himself didn't actually attend school, but he did hang out an awful lot with the college crowd, which probably sounds familiar to you.
Yeah. Very much so.
Your Clemson by proxy education.
Yes, absolutely.
So.
Wasn't hanging out with musicians, though.
Yeah. No, but you were hanging out with, like, future entrepreneurs. There's that.
That's true, yes.
Terry was offered a position in friend James Garcia's band, Illinois Speed Press. That was the name of the band. But Terry turned it down because he didn't want to play bass. He wanted to get back to playing guitar and singing lead. And Terry, Walter, Danny, and Lee soon recruited... Oh, sorry. Maybe... Is Walter... Shit, what does Walter play? Is he a sax player?
No, I thought
Terry,
you were
Walter,
saying...
Danny, and Lee soon recruited trombone player James Pankow. Shit, what did...
And you were saying somebody already played Walter... sax.
I said that Walter played... trombone. That's not right. Walter Perezader. Yeah, he was winds. So he played sax primarily.
Okay.
Oh, he could play saxophone, flute, and clarinet. Oh, he was the one who played Color My World.
Wind instrument. You just said winds.
Well, yeah.
No, I'm kidding.
So that's another. It's a woodwind.
We have to explain it to our audience.
Sorry, woodwind.
As if they don't know.
Anyway.
that means you put a popsicle stick in your instrument at some point.
It's called a reed, but you know.
That's what I always called it when I was a little kid.
A popsicle stick. It does kind of look like it.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Yeah, reed. Woodwind and brass instruments are interesting. It's interesting being a person who does not play wind or brass and then seeing all the spit that comes out of those instruments. Oh, anyway. Yeah. anyway, they recruited trombone player James Pankow and keyboard player Robert Lamb, and thus the Lion's Share of Chicago was born. Only at this point, they were called The Big Thing.
Yeah, that name sucks, too.
Chicago's better.
Yeah,
honestly.
Way better. The Big Thing.
The Big Thing.
At Nokia Theater. The Big Thing. Like, is that a movie? Is it a band?
It does sound like the sequel to The Thing.
Right, The Big Thing. Yeah.
One night, a member of a big Midwest band called The Exceptions...
Not the rules.
Yes. Heard them and was blown away by The Big Thing's horn section. Pun intended, blown away, get it? That Exceptions member was one vocalist and bassist, Peter Cetera. The Big Thing just so happened to be missing a bass player, as well as someone who could sing uncomfortably high.
And so, yeah, like... way too many octaves high.
Yes.
Like, almost to, like, Mariah Carey's level.
Mm-hmm. And so Cetera was invited to join the band, much to Terry's chagrin, because he and Peter initially actually didn't really get along. So
it was also that song was also featured in the Grand Theft Auto 5 game in quite a funny moment. But,
if you leave me now?
Yes.
Okay.
And it involved Trevor Phillips.
Yeah.
It was a really funny scene.
Okay.
When that song starts playing, it's like that's kind of hilarious.
James Corsaro became their manager and requested that they all move out to L.A., which they did, though they kept a name consistent.
I mean, that is literally what you had to do back then.
Back then. Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, it was L.A. or New York. It was one or the other.
Mm-hmm. And they kept a name consistent with their Midwest roots, Chicago Transit Authority.
Yeah. I mean, think of how big of a city Chicago is. Even back then, it might even have been bigger. And it's like, no, if we want to make it in the entertainment world, we've got to go to one of the coasts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even though Chicago is like kind of considered as like, you know, the like what like the crown jewel of the Midwest.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what you. It's like, no, we don't have the audience here in Chicago.
Right. Well, or the recording studios that right. LA was the place in the US and New York to an extent. But they were originally called Chicago Transit Authority.
I think. Your dad mentioned that.
Their debut album was also called Chicago Transit Authority, but they did eventually truncate it to Chicago. Now, another music corner. Again, as someone who knows...
All of the corners of music.
Horn bands are a different breed of bands.
Yeah, for sure.
It's one thing for a band to have a horn player. Very famously, Bruce Springsteen in the E Street Band had Clarence.
Just one?
Clarence Clemons, yeah.
But just, that's what I'm saying, just one, though?
Yeah, yeah, I guess. Just Clarence. Yeah. On sax, the big man, right? It is another thing, a completely different thing for
to have like a section.
A horn section, exactly. A horn section plays parts. In other words, they all need to be playing like the same rhythm, unless it's counterpoint.
They have to be
that's a whole other thing.
They have to be harmonious.
They have to be in harmony with each other, exactly. And a good horn section will be tight. So it you can't necessarily pick out one individual horn. It kind of blends together.
Yeah.
Very much like a good harmony section. Like think of the Doobie Brothers. Could you pick out
immediately thought of the Eagles.
Could you pick out individual voices? And it's kind of you can't really not lead, of course, but otherwise.
If you were paying attention a little harder, maybe yes. But yeah. But for the most part, mm-hmm. just hearing it,
mm-hmm.
no.
Because the whole point is to move completely as a group, and that's the case in horns too. And it is tough to do that because sure. that means if you're playing a note, you're playing that note the exact duration as the person standing next to you, right? It's almost like requires a psychic attunement.
And the way I've always understood it too is you've got to be on the same pitch as well, which is
oh, of course you have to be in tune with each other,
which
yes.
is hard to do. That in itself is not necessarily easy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And being in a horn section requires not thinking of yourself as a single horn player, but thinking of yourself as part of a horn section.
There are 25 people listening now. Like,
come on.
No, I am too.
And yeah, the same holds true for a good vocal section. Now, to be fair, at this point, so this is the late 60s, right? Like 69. Horns were kind of having a moment
in
pop and rock music. Yeah. So while Chicago...
Especially in pop.
Mm-hmm. While Chicago was forming, moving to the West Coast, East Coast band Blood, Sweat, and Tears was also on their way up. They, of the famous, are we ready? First clip.
I know the name of this band.
Oh, yeah, you'll know this song.
Oh, yes. What goes up? Yep.
Must come down. Ready for the cowbell?
And this was all early rock music was the drumming was all jazz based.
Well, and to be fair, Blood, Sweat, and Tears was very jazzy. Mm-hmm. You can hear it there.
Yeah, for sure.
And very keys heavy. Yeah. Keyboards played more heavily in these bands because that was more common in jazz.
Like
too.
A more hard rock style of drumming really didn't come out until like the late 70s, early 80s, like with metal
unless you
music.
Count like for this type of music, like Chicago had some heavier stuff, like 25 or 64. Mm-hmm. But anyway. Now, this sort of horn-driven, new, jazzy, pop, rock sort of thing was at least in part due to James Garcia, who, in addition to Chicago, had produced the mid-60s pop band The Buckinghams, whose horn and keyboard-driven sound was a precursor of the jazzier Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears. So this is kind of a drag. That's I'm not describing the song.
Oh,
that's
it's the name of the song.
By The Buckinghams. You can kind
of
tell.
Very of the era.
It is very of the era. Yeah. You're absolutely right. You can tell the difference of just a few years.
Yeah.
Right? Even the Blood, Sweat, and Tears song, like, these two songs are only separated by a couple, 2-3 years, right. A handful of years. But you can hear the vast shift in the style
absolutely.
There. Mm-hmm. Another band utilizing some of these elements at the time were the Outsiders, whose drummer Jimmy Fox would go on to found The James Gang, which featured one, Joe Walsh. But this is, I fucking love this song. This is The Outsiders' Time Won't Let Me. Bop, isn't it? I love that song.
That was Taylor Hawkins' favorite band.
The Outsiders?
No, the James Gang.
Oh, that wasn't the James Gang. That was the Outsiders.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were playing James Gang.
Yes, the drummer went on to play
James
Gang.
Oh, okay.
No, they did, what is the song that just went out of my head?
I don't know.
Of James Gang. Did they do Rocky Mountain Way, or was that just Joe Walsh?
I don't know them very well.
My dad
really
likes
don't.
James Gang. Let's see. Funk 49. I know where you're going.
Oh, sure. Yep.
And Walk Away. Okay. Seems to me Yep. You don't want to talk about it, seems to me. You just turn your pretty head and walk away. And that... It's a jam.
Yeah. Anyway.
Anyway, Chicago.
this episode, you knew, our dear listeners, about 2 minutes in that this episode was going to devolve into music.
Devolve. Come on.
No, I know.
So while both Chicago and Blood, Sweat, and Tears were a bit jazzier than the likes of the Buckinghams and the Outsiders, Chicago managed to be simultaneously a bit more polished and a bit more rock and roll than Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Their first album, Chicago Transit Authority, a double album, like you said, released in 1969, was a double album with a runtime of 76 minutes.
That's nuts for...
It's 1969.
It was like, you know what? It was like, we could release this later as an EP, but like, right. Fuck it. Like, let's just put it out.
Mm-hmm. Terry wrote the opening track, which is called Introduction. Because he never learned how to read music, James Pankow had to notate the incredibly complicated horn parts for him.
Jeez,
and
yeah.
An issue sometimes with people who don't actually write music is that when they do sing or whatever, it can involve like time changes, key signature changes, like all sorts of stuff, because they're not playing within the rules of music, right? Which is fine, you don't have to, but it can be really tricky to notate what you have to do when you have horns. So,
especially when you're live.
Yes, or just recording, yeah. Just it performing in general. So Chicago Transit Authority does include the previously mentioned, does anybody really know what time it is?
Hey, I haven't heard this song in a while, but I know it because of that piano part.
Yeah. And then, ready?
Yeah.
Great. Great solo. Anyway. That's, yes, I have a soft spot for, does anybody really know what time it is, or Dark Witty?
No, Yes was a 70s band.
When we played it in my band, I would say, okay, we're going to play.
That's a tough song.
It's great. We did it pretty well. Yeah, we actually did it really well. Rich is a great keyboardist. He did great.
I'm not sure if I've ever heard you guys play that.
It was a while back. Maybe we should bring it back. I don't know. John would love it. He's always into when we play Chicago, but we've played that Saturday in the Park and 25 or 6 to 4.
Yeah, I've heard those. I don't think I've ever heard you guys play that.
No, it was, like should. I said, it was a while ago.
It'd be a fun one.
What was I going to say? Huh, must not have been. Oh, Dark Witty. So when I would say, you know, we were going to do this song at practice in the band, I would say, does anybody really know what time it is? And one guy... Glenn, you know, always then announce the time as if I had asked, does anybody really know what time it is? So I stopped calling it that and started using the acronym of the song, which is Dark Witty.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, Dark Witty. And that became the shorthand for the song. Anyway, leading a band has its challenges. So this album also contains other hits. This band has a lot of hits, too, just over the years. It includes Beginnings. Oh, we do Beginnings, too. We do still do Beginnings in Peak City Sound. And I'm a Man, which we have done in Peak. Oh, I said the name of the band. I don't know if I should have.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, probably not. Anyway.
It's
anyone could find it out.
Yes.
But for as much as the album, this opening album has a jazz/prog rock band, one of Terry's two contributions to the album is a hard left turn from like the smoother, jazzier Chicago sound. Free form guitar.
It's fucking shredding.
Was created in a single take by Terry, and we're going to listen to some of it. We're not going to listen to the whole thing because but I recommend listening to it. This is all guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And no pedals, apparently.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He must be standing like right in front of his
Yeah. Amp. Anyway. Yeah. Anyway, there's 6.5 minutes of that.
Okay.
But I'm one of the. I mean, this is. That was 1969. That was really forward
sure.
for 1969. One of the techniques Terry uses in that piece is called two-handed tapping. So tapping mm-hmm. the guitar is when instead of plucking the string, you tap up on the fretboard with your fingertips. And two-handed tapping is when you do it with both hands mm-hmm. instead of fingering the frets with the non-dominant hand.
Isn't that also a hammer-on? Isn't that what that's also called?
Or is no, that kind of hammer-on a... is when you have your finger down on one fret and then you add
the right.
next without mm-hmm. playing the string again. That's so, right. yeah. Anyway, two-handed tapping means that you can get a higher velocity of notes because you're using both hands to tap. This was popularized by one Edward Van Halen.
Absolutely.
Who used it very famously as soon as you brought in Eruption. It up,
that's exactly what I thought of.
Terry was doing this when Eddie Van Halen was 14 years old.
That's interesting.
So he was well ahead of his time and not well known for being so ahead of his time. There is something very 1969 about freeform guitar. It was recorded in January of 69, about 6 months or so before Jimi Hendrix played the Star Spangled Banner at Woodstock, which is sort of like a spiritual precedent of that. In fact, it is well documented that Hendrix greatly admired Terry Kath.
That's crazy.
Isn't it?
Well, and also, like, I've always thought of Eddie Van Halen of the second best guitarist next to Jimi Hendrix. And they're both influenced by this guy, apparently.
Right. So the band had a relationship with Hendrix because they opened for him in their earlier LA days. According to Walter Perezader, Hendrix told him, quote, "Your guitar player is better than me," end quote. Hendrix is also quoted as calling Terry, quote, "the best guitarist in the universe," end quote. That's, like, that seems to be well documented.
No shit. That's
so
crazy.
Hendrix was like, no, this guy is good. And so a lot of times, if you, like, Google Terry Kath, he'll come up as, like, the greatest, least known guitar player, sort of. Because when you think of great, like, if an average person sort of conjures up, okay, who are the great guitar players? Terry Kath usually doesn't come to mind instantly.
Because he wasn't in the forefront, really.
It was Chicago was a big band. Yeah, that had a lot of creative input.
Like eight guys?
Yeah, there was a bunch of people. Yeah. And it grew and shrank over the years, but yeah.
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Whatever rock leanings Chicago had are primarily attributed to Terry, who's credited as having swayed the band towards more what they called long hair music back in the day. In 1970 came the release of Chicago, the album, later retroactively called Chicago 2. Featuring one of the most recognized and well-regarded guitar solos in rock history. And it was executed by, of course, Terry Kath. And we're probably going to listen to more of this than we should. It is one of my favorite guitar solos. So
it's a really
I'm just going to kind of jump into it.
Yeah.
Here's where it gets great. Right here. Amazing. I mean, that is a damn good guitar solo. I highly recommend listen to it from the beginning because he builds it so great too. It is so
That's
good.
True because that solo is like 2 minutes long.
It's a long
and
solo.
It's a constant And there's never, and like the apex is at the very end.
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
You can hear in that where Terry starts using the wah pedal and he gets like a whack a whack a wow yeah. wow. It sounds like a talk box a little bit, which would later, it wasn't even, I'm not even sure it was possible back then or even existed back then. It would get popularized in
Frampton
the 70s.
Used one. Yeah, Frampton the late,
did late very
70s.
Famously, but so did Joe Walsh.
That's true.
Rocky Mountain Way. Wow. Wow. Wow.
So did Bon Jovi.
I don't actually know the words to the verses.
If it was playing, I'd be able to sing. Yeah. It's like, yeah. I was going to say, if it was playing, I'd be able to sing every word because I've heard that song 5 million times.
But that was 1970.
That's pretty crazy.
He was really like one of the first to do some of this stuff. Now, one of the things that's odd about Chicago, or interesting, depending on how you look at it, is how disparate some of their music was. Not in terms of sound. They did have a cohesion in those early days, due to the horns, the harmonies, the vocalists. But they could rock out with something like 25 or 6 to 4, like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that was some hard rock for 1970.
No, that's a fucking, that's a banger, that song.
But I'm going to play you another song that's on the same album, just to remember that.
Yeah.
This is Color My World. It's a pretty song. It's also really fucking boring.
And it sounds pretty depressing, too.
Oh, here, I was gonna play where the vocals come into it so you can actually hear it.
As time goes on. Yeah.
This is like fucking soft rock.
Yeah.
So they do that, and then on the same album, they're doing this.
I know, right? Yeah.
The drums coming in is the best part.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just trying to point out the contrast.
Yes.
Now that Color My World has long been a popular song, just to be fair. So it's 25 or 6 to 4, but anyway. Regardless of the band's unique stylings, Chicago 2, which was another double album, that came out 1 year after their first double album, to be clear, was a certified, huh?
Oh, I was going to say, but back then people just churned out albums.
They really did.
To
kind of a shocking
It wasn't like when we grew up where it was like, oh, you have an album like every 2 years. It's
right.
Like, no,
best,
you have like three albums in a 2 year span.
They really spat them out.
Yeah.
It was a certified hit. It really put Chicago on the map, pun intended. Chicago 2 did. Then came Chicago 3. Another double album, released in January 71. This is literally three albums in less than 2 years.
Yeah.
Three albums in less than 2 years.
And honestly, it's like six
albums. Double
albums,
yes. Six albums, exactly. This band has always been incredibly prolific. They had multiple songwriters, so they could churn this stuff out. Terry was with them every step of the way until his death 9 years after the first album was recorded. He is featured on a total of 9 of their studio albums because, yes, they recorded a new album every single year from 1969 to actually 1980.
That's fucking nuts.
Isn't it?
Jeez.
If you tried to collect the entire, like, all the Chicago albums, that would be a collection in its own.
It would cost some money.
Yes. Now, getting back to the band's stark contrast of songs. The turning point seems to have kind of come with the recording and release of Chicago 10, which was released in June 1976. The Cetera penned If You Leave Me Now from that album turned out to be quite the game changer for the band. Yeah, so we're gonna play a little bit of that. Just again, think of 25 or 6 to 4, and then they were doing stuff like this. Triangle or bell.
Triangle. If you leave me
now, you'll take away the pain. We have to do the oohs.
Ooh, no, baby, please don't go.
And then he did like, baby, what a big surprise. And, like, all of his songs sound the fucking same.
Dude, he did the fucking theme song from Karate Kid 2.
Isn't it Glory of Love?
Yes.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
I am the man.
Yeah, that's how
who
I knew.
Will fight for your honor.
That's how I knew Peter Cetera when I was a kid. That was like the Karate Kid 2 guy.
Also, how is The Glory of Love a valid song for a Karate Kid movie?
Yeah, I know. He didn't even bang her. Like, it was. They had like, they kind of had a kiss, and then a typhoon happened. That's literally what happened.
She taught him how to
make like the tea, you know, like the.
I don't think I ever saw Karate Kid.
It's probably so horrible
that we should watch
that
it.
We should watch it.
Oh man, so
I doubt it aged well.
I'm sure. So while Chicago had always hit the Billboard like top 10, right? Like that was, they were pretty consistent. If You Leave Me Now was their first Billboard number one.
Yeah, I mean, that's fucking big. It was a big song.
Yeah. I still don't know why, but it was.
I know. It's like, it doesn't make sense. But, yeah. But sometimes it doesn't have to.
Yeah. It also showed that Peter Cetera had a possible place as a hit songwriter in the band.
Fuck yeah.
And in a band with many creatives, including the three primary songwriters of Terry Kath, James Pankow, and Robert Lamb, it started kind of crowding in onto the others' real estate, right, on the record.
Peter's like, I've got maybe solo work coming up.
Well, yeah, we'll get into that later. And it started taking the band in a very different musical direction, which was not everyone's favorite idea, especially not Terry's. So by this point, Terry's starting to get tired of playing in a band that he was increasingly losing control over. He's a band leader, right? I will tell you, as a person who is a band leader, not being in control of the band is difficult.
I was just gonna say, may I say, like, you were a band leader, mm-hmm. then you weren't, and now you're band leader again.
Yeah. It's hard to walk away forever. So by the end of 1977, Terry was seriously working on building his own band. He kind of wanted to get away from horns. Well, he wanted to start a traditional band that he could control.
Also, like with those bigger bands, all those bigger bands, they all have their little side projects. Mm-hmm. I mean, they all do.
That's very true. That's very true.
You know.
And he planned to start working on his own solo album in January of 1978. Here is, just for reference, this is... He's a Rangers fan.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
That's
New York
Terry.
Rangers.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's him jamming out.
Mm-hmm. He was a big guy. Like, he was tall solid.
Got a pretty giant head.
Yeah. The guitar looks pretty small.
It does. Yeah.
But it was just a standard guitar.
Maybe that's why he could shred it. Like, look at his fingers go over the entire fretboard.
Right.
Like,
yes.
It's nothing.
He has very big hands. He probably wasn't, bass was probably super easy for him. Those are all stickers that he put on his guitar. Do you see what that is?
No, it's Blackhawks.
Yeah, it's a Blackhawks sticker.
But he's wearing a Rangers jersey.
I know, I don't quite get that either. But anyway. All right, so while Terry's involvement in the band lasted about a decade, it was a very formative decade in his life, let alone anyone's life. This was basically his entire 20s. He was in Chicago.
Sure.
And this was the 60s and the 70s. It was normal to get married in your 20s, start having
kids. Oh, God,
kids.
Yeah. Yeah. It was normal to get married when you were, like, 17.
Right? And as you can imagine, being in a popular and very busy touring and recording band didn't exactly make Terry the ideal family man. Nevertheless, he did get married to Pamela Robinson in 1970. Kind of unsurprisingly, their marriage was not the best. Ended in divorce in 1975. And then he married Michigander Camelia Ortiz soon thereafter. And together they had their daughter, Michelle. And this is Terry. Now you can really see how big he is with a little baby.
Yeah, right.
And Michelle. And that's basically like... Michelle doesn't really have memories of Terry.
Yeah.
Which we'll get to.
Okay.
But... So in Michelle's documentary about her father, the documentary is called Chicago, the Terry Kath Experience. If you have Peacock, you can watch it. I'll talk a little bit about it later too, but Camelia talks about, so that's his wife at the time, about how Terry had an interest in guns, though just for recreational shooting. He wasn't a hunter. She said he just liked to like target practice. She said he liked guns, cars, and guitars. According to Peter Cetera, Terry once fired a gun Into the Air on stage at one of their concerts.
Okay.
I advise against that.
Something that will for sure get you arrested today.
Yes.
Like, on the spot.
Now, given the circumstances, being in a rock band churning out all these songs, it's probably also not surprising to learn that Terry drank and did a lot of drugs. I mean, that's what happens if you're in a rock band in the 70s. It's kind of a foregone conclusion, unless you were specifically sober. He was not. When his daughter interviewed Joe Walsh as part of her documentary, Joe Walsh said, quote, "We were all high. The whole audience were just as high as we were," end quote. He just means in general in the 70s. Sure. Like, yeah. Everyone was high. The drug use within the band as a whole apparently took a turn for the much more serious in 1974 when they recorded Chicago 7, which is ironically their sixth album. At Garcia's...
They were so high they couldn't fucking
exactly.
count.
Exactly.
Like, which one? Seven? Sure.
At Garcia's Caribou Ranch in Nederland, Colorado, Danny Serafine said, quote, "That's when the drugs got heavier and things got weirder. There was cocaine everywhere," end quote. So they're moving on to harder drugs.
Yeah, I mean, they can't even count albums.
Yeah. In the documentary, one of them, I forget who, tells a story of... Terry, like, wrecking his car, and then he walked away from it okay, but then he, like, went back to the car, and they're like, "Terry, are you okay?" And he's like, "Yeah, I'm just going back for my pot."
Yeah.
So,
it's true, there was, and and because of the Vietnam War, I mean, there was, like, a serious case of drunk driving accidents in the 70s.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So much so that we created laws
to curb
that.
Yeah. The band also said that Terry seemed to have a bizarrely high tolerance for drugs. He's also a big guy. So,
yeah.
And he used far more than would be generally considered to be in any way safe. Not that I think there's any, like, safe dose of cocaine, but, you know. There were also concerns about Terry's increasing love for guns, given that he was on drugs much of the time.
Yeah.
At one point, Chicago was partying with the Beach Boys. And Terry began playing Russian roulette.
Mm-hmm.
And it rightly freaked out Carl Wilson so much he literally ran up to Terry and knocked the gun out of his hand. Like, trying to save his life, quite literally. Terry punched him in the face.
Yeah.
And then they all had to hold Terry back from, like, beating his ass
up. So. Not a small dude.
No. No. Unfortunately, Terry's love for drugs and guns would prove to be deadly. By the weekend of January 21st, 1978, Terry was on kind of like a cocaine bender. He was on coke for a few days straight. On the evening of Sunday, January 22nd, he visited Chicago percussionist Lodir de Oliveira. Oliveira. Now, Chicago really had a revolving door of band members eventually.
Sure, yes.
Though Oliveira had joined in 1973. In an interesting but very morbid bit of trivia, Oliveira ended up literally dropping dead of a heart attack while playing percussion on stage in Brazil in 2017 at the age of 77.
No shit.
Yep. They said they looked over and saw that he was, like, face down on his instrument or whatever, and he was dead on the scene. Yeah.
Well, not the worst way to go out.
He was doing what he loved.
Yeah. Sounded pretty sudden.
So Oliveira ended up being the last band member who saw Terry before he died. They sat up all night talking before Terry went to a party. So the next day, it was on Monday, the 23rd, at roadie Don Johnson, no relation, Don Johnson's apartment in the Woodland Hills neighborhood of Los Angeles. Johnson was also a heavy drug user. One band member alluded to him maybe being Terry's drug dealer.
Mm.
By this point in his life, Terry was literally just regularly carrying guns on him. After the party, he and Johnson were sitting around in Johnson's apartment. Terry pulled out the guns he had on him, and I say plural because there was at least two. One was an unloaded .38 revolver, which he pointed at his head and pulled the trigger. It was unloaded. Nothing happened. But Johnson, whether he was freaked out because he was high or whatever, like, rightly was understandably concerned and warned him, like, don't fucking do that. Now, I am not at all a firearm user, but I do know you're not supposed to aim the gun at anything you don't intend
absolutely
to shoot.
Absolutely fucking not. The only time I've fired a gun in my entire life mm-hmm. was at a friend of mine's bachelor party. And
oh, yeah, you went, like, skeet shooting or something, mm-hmm. right?
And they said, they were like, you can only load and unload your firearm at this station.
Uh-huh.
They're like, and if we see you doing it anywhere else, like, you're gone.
Yeah.
Like, no mm-hmm. questions, because... Yeah, you could fucking accidentally kill yourself.
Yeah.
Or, you know, most likely somebody else.
Could also happen. Because
there was like a station, and mm-hmm. when you're all changing out, everybody's facing away from each other.
So there's nobody to aim at.
Nope.
And, yeah.
And, yeah. They're like, if you do it anywhere else but there, like, mm-hmm. you're gone.
Terry then started cleaning a 9mm semi-automatic pistol that he also had on him. And again, Johnson's like, hey, dude, like, be careful. Terry showed Johnson that the gun's clip was in his hand, not actually loaded in the pistol. And I had to look all of this up because, like I said, I'm not a gun person. But basically,
I kind of know what they mean. But.
From what I can tell, the magazine is the part of the gun that actually holds the ammunition, and the clip is the part that helps load the ammunition into the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of a 9mm, or at least this 9mm, if the clip is not loaded, if the clip's not in the gun, it can't fire. So when he had it in his hand, it's like, look, like, I can't even fire this.
It's disengaged.
Yeah. Terry also knew that the magazine was empty, so there was no ammo in the magazine, so he thought the gun was not loaded. What Terry did not realize is that one bullet was in the chamber of the gun.
Yep.
He put the clip back into the gun, started, like, gesturing, waving it around. And according to Johnson, he said, quote, what do you think I'm going to do? Blow my brains out? End quote. And as Terry was waving the gun, those were his last words. It ended up being pointed at his temple at some point, and he accidentally pulled the trigger.
Mm.
And died instantly.
Yeah. Can you...
yeah. Well. So I know you, when we took a quick break, you know, you said that it was your recollection he died from Russian roulette. It was my recollection, too. That's not what happened.
No, it was...
He thought it was an unloaded gun.
Right.
I mean, the whole thing is being told by someone who was likely very high at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Don Johnson. But there's really not a reason to think that he's lying or necessarily misremembering, because this would probably really stick in your brain.
Here's for what sure happened. He died.
Yes, but it seems that he died not by trying to tempt fate, but by a literal accidental.
Sure.
Like, thinking the gun was unloaded, not being particularly careful.
And he's not realizing there's one, neither of them are, probably because they're both high as fuck.
Yeah, there's not one. They didn't know there was one in the chamber. Yeah.
I mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because when you were going into all that, the whole time I'm thinking, anything, I just know this. Basically, anything that has a clip, like, if you just load it once,
mm-hmm.
or, like, do the whatever, like, there's a bullet in the chamber. Like, you have to... So when you were going through that, I'm like, but there's still a bullet in the chamber.
Yeah, there was.
I'm like, and he's probably too fucking high to realize that. Yeah. Everybody's too high to realize mm-hmm. that. I mean, can you... Jeez, can you imagine the fucking shit that these guys were doing back then?
Yeah.
I mean...
It was not good.
No.
It was not good.
Yeah, he's on his third day of doing cocaine
all
the time.
Yeah. Don Johnson called Danny Seraphine, who immediately drove to Johnson's apartment and found Johnson, like, basically crying in the corner. Probably freaking out, too.
Yeah.
And he saw Terry's body lying on the couch, quote, staring off blankly into the distance, end quote. And he stayed while the police arrived. The coroner removed the body. Apparently, Danny Seraphine said that the coroner asked him for help moving the body because he was so big.
And dead, literally dead weight.
Yes, and Danny Seraphine was like, no fucking way. I am not touching my dead friend's body. Which, fair enough. I'm like, I'm not gonna. So Chicago came pretty close to breaking up after Terry's death. But they did end up hanging on, though their popularity initially started to wane. In 1981, they switched labels after being dropped by their previous label, Columbia, ended up with a new producer, David Foster, who was like, hey, you know what direction we need to go in? Peter Cetera singing soft rock.
Soft rock direction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Robert Lamb speculated that Chicago would not have gone on to be the easy listening band they basically turned into if Terry had lived and remained part of the group. Oh, hell no. He said, quote, had Terry survived and been part of Chicago as it went into the 1980s, this band's history would have been very different. Terry would have opposed the balladic direction that we were sucked into. He'd put a stop to that or he'd have left the band.
They would, you know what they would have been? They would have been one of the 80s, one of the few half a dozen like 80s prog rock bands. Mm-hmm. Because they did exist in the 80s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And each one of them put out like a hit.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like Yes put out mm-hmm. like a hit.
Well, they did more.
True, and well, yes, now that I think about it, Genesis put out.
Genesis, uh-huh.
Yeah, but their roots were all like serious prog rock stuff. Mm-hmm. That's probably where they would have landed.
They could have, yeah.
In that same, they probably would have been like touring with Genesis, like yeah. shit like that, you know.
Cetera turned into the band's primary songwriter, and the others were increasingly edged out. Though Cetera contends that it was because he was the only band member to sober up and the rest of them had become pretty useless due to their drug habits. It could be both, too, you know.
Yeah.
Lamb had a different perspective, saying, quote, Foster was talented, but he was also smarmy. He bought into the whole ballad thing.
I can see that.
Once Cetera had started writing and Foster was on board, then all those outsiders started affecting what we were doing. Peter Cetera left the band and went to solo in 1985, and that's sort of when the revolving door of members became a thing. Unfortunately, longstanding member Walt Perezader was forced to retire from touring in 2017 after nearly 50 years with the band due to a heart condition, but then it was revealed in 2021 that he had also been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Mm, yeah. Regardless, Chicago has continued to record and tour up to the present day. Their 2024 tour with Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Oh, I was gonna, yeah, okay.
Another horn band begins.
I might have guessed that.
Yeah. Begins, they've also toured with the Doobie Brothers.
So that are Tower of Power.
Begins on May 15th in La Vista, Nebraska. If we want to see them.
Are they coming here?
They'll be at Walnut Creek on August 12th.
You know what?
You wanna?
Maybe.
Hmm? We can think about it.
Hey.
And that, my friends...
We'll bring our parents.
My dad would love it.
He would. You know what? Yes, he would. Yeah, I think we should go.
And that, my friends, was the story of the death of Terry Kath.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I did not realize, and I just knew that it happened.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, I did think it was Russian roulette.
I did too, initially.
Because I always surrounding the story was like, hey, have you ever seen that movie...
Faces of Death.
Or... No, where the guy shoot?
Oh,
the
Deer Hunter. Yeah.
It's like, well, that's what happened to the guitarist of the Chicago. And it's like, what? Yeah. Really? Like the Peter Cetera band?
Chicago? Right. Because
uh-huh. when I was...
That's what they were
when
doing,
they went into their soft rock era mm-hmm. was when I was like a little kid.
Uh-huh.
And my mom listened to that shit. Like, my mom listened to like that and like Crystal Gale. And
uh-huh. Did your mom... So... My mom definitely listened to some soft rock in the day. Do you know the song? And I don't even, I'd have to look up who did it, but like, When I Need Love.
Oh, yeah, sure, yes. I don't know who, couldn't tell you who sings it. But this was also, like maybe when Bette Midler was at her peak, too.
Oh,
she had
geez.
All those, I mean,
did
I heard all that.
Did you know that you're my
I fucking
hero.
Heard all that shit. Yeah. But
oh,
thankful.
God, what a. Bad
but,
era.
But thankfully, I had older sisters, and when we got cable TV, then I had MTV.
Right.
So, yeah, a lot of other people saved me. But
from the terrors of soft rock.
But yes, I mean, and I'm not joking, like, my knowledge of Peter Cetera comes from the Karate Kid Part 2.
Yeah.
And I heard that, I probably had the 45. I wouldn't, like, my mom probably had it. Mm-hmm. She's like, hey, that's Peter Cetera. He's my favorite.
Jeez.
Him, I wish he would do an album with Crystal Gale.
I just love, was it Robert Lamb who said, I think it, yeah, that David Foster, their producer, who's like, yes, let's go in this direction. I love that he said he was smarmy.
Yeah.
I'm sure what he was thinking is he's a fucking douchebag.
Fuck yeah, of course. He was like, we are going to write the same song over and over again forever and make a shit ton of money. Like, that's exactly where he was coming from.
I will say that, so the the Terry Kath Experience documentary. It is on Peacock to watch. I did watch it.
How long is it?
An hour, 20 minutes. Oh, okay. Like so, all right. I will say
80 minutes is good for a doc.
Yeah. It was kind of interesting. So his daughter was the director and producer of this, right? It wasn't what I thought it was going to be. It wasn't terribly fact intensive about Terry. Like I watched it so that I could maybe learn more about his childhood and stuff. Didn't really. What I thought was really interesting about it. So he died before she turned two.
So she's the same age as me. Because he died in 78, right?
Yeah. So she would have been. Yeah. It would have been. She was either born in 76 or 77. Yeah. And so she has no memory of him.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
And the documentary feels very much that way. It feels very much like a woman trying to learn who he was, but not finding out a ton.
Something's not really there. Something's missing a little bit. Yeah.
Like, she clearly...
There's a bit of a void.
Yeah, like, clearly this is her dad, so she cares, but she didn't have, like...
She had literally no relationship with him.
Yes, yes.
That she recalls.
And apparently, like, because she met up with all the band members, Peter Cetera's in it, like, the whole thing. And he was like,
I'll give you my signed Karate Kid 2.
They all commented, they were like, you look eerily like him.
Sure.
They all thought that she looked a lot like him. And, like, mannerisms and stuff like that, which is interesting because, you know, she didn't even know him. And her mom was in the documentary, too. But, it felt kind of like someone who's trying to find an emotional connection. And
maybe there isn't one.
Well, it's hard to have one, right? There was clearly a lot of emotional connection with the people she was interviewing. Like, they had an emotional connection to Terry Kath because they knew him so much and so well. And I will say that for as much shit as I gave Peter Cetera in this, he said that he still has dreams about Terry. And that it on one spot of Saturday in the Park, every time he sings it, he looks like he thinks of Terry and looks up to the sky. Like that's his like little that's personal. Right.
They have that song too. Yeah, they have so many hits.
So many hits.
Like when we not that they're two different eras and genres. The first time I saw Stone Temple Pilots was in 2009, which was after their heyday. They'd made a bit of a comeback, just like a lot of '90s bands did.
Yeah.
Towards the end of the 2000s, because there's always that
right
15 year is what it's called.
Cycle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, at the end of it, we were like, man, they played this song and that. Like, I forgot about that song.
Yeah.
They had that song, and like, we fucking knew every fucking song.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, forgot how fucking good this band was. Mm-hmm. And you know, Chicago's like one of those types of bands.
Yes.
Like, you forget how fucking good they are
and how many hits they really
have. And you're like, oh, that's Chicago. Mm-hmm. I fucking know that's Chicago. I know that one.
Yeah. Another something that I did think was really interesting. Well, in the documentary, they show her trying to find her dad's guitar, the one with all the stickers on it, and she does finally find it. But they also show footage from her wedding. So at this point, by the time she did the documentary, she had little kids, like the whole bit. She had already gotten married, had kids. They showed footage from her wedding, and her stepfather. I think it was at the wedding itself. You know, he got up to do a toast, her stepfather.
Sure. Yeah.
And like, did it kind of on behalf of Terry. Terry had written a song for her.
Oh, okay.
And he like read the lyrics. It was very, very, very sweet. It was a beautifully sweet moment. Her stepdad's Kiefer Sutherland.
What the fuck?
Plot twist! Plot Jesus twist! Christ. I know. I was like, wait, is that Kiefer Sutherland?
We've got into like fucking X-Files territory almost.
It was very weird because they showed him like walking her down the aisle. I'm like, he looks like Kiefer Sutherland. It was Kiefer Sutherland.
You know what? It would have been even weirder if it was Donald Sutherland. Was
the age would have been a little off, I think. But.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I just had to.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that is a bit of an obscure story, but I think enough people know about it where it's not it's not quite a heavy hitter.
Right.
But it's something that's kind of known.
Yeah.
That's, but But yeah, because I mean, the one I was gonna come up with for our 350 was also music related.
Really?
So, yes.
Well, we like doing the music related ones. Yeah, they're fun for us.
Yes, they are fun for us.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody likes them, but they're fun.
Sadly.
For us.
For our audience, maybe not. But I think so, because there are plenty of people in our audience that are very much into music, and it kind of doesn't matter as far as talking about music what you're into. Mm-hmm. It's just talking about, like, I love this band for this reason, and mm-hmm. they can do this, and mm-hmm. you know, that's universal, no matter what you're into.
And Chicago really was an interesting and unique band, especially early on. Like, they had a song, I think maybe on their first album, that included audio. The whole world is watching. The whole world is watching. It was the Chicago Democratic National Convention.
Oh,
going
like,
on.
Yes, in
at
like
that point.
68,
yes. I guess.
I was
going
to say, I think 68 was mm-hmm. like the where all the riots took place.
Right.
Because of Vietnam.
And they were making like political statements too. They were long hairs, you know, or whatever, so
yeah.
It's pretty and their musicianship is pretty
unparalleled.
Oh, yeah. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and just like listening to the shit that Terry was doing is it's almost that hands as big as his could move as fast as
like
he
all
did,
I could, like all you can say is like imagine if he was still alive and being like
yeah
I was Jimi Hendrix like favorite guitar
yes.
player like
yes.
that Jimi Hendrix
no,
yeah that one
I was better than Jimi Hendrix
yeah,
I am better than Jimi Hendrix
he said so
yes he literally told people that
yeah. I mean that's
because everyone else was calling Hendrix the best guitarist in the world so like Eric Clapton was jealous of Jimi Hendrix.
And you know
Hendrix.
What? I mean, they were probably influencing each other without even knowing it.
Yes.
Because he's
probably
hearing them like, how the fuck is he doing that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me try this.
Right.
And,
But it's like, if the ultimate guitar god says that you're the guitar god, then you are the ultimate guitar god.
Then you're the guitar
god.
Then you're the guitar
god. Basically.
Yeah. You got some bragging rights mm-hmm. forever.
Yes. And
talk about a lifetime exemption.
Yeah. And unfortunately for and Jimmy too, who we'll cover at some point, you know, the fucking drugs, man. Like,
oh, back then it was just fucking nuts. It's like, how did any of these bands survive?
It was, but it has continued to be not for nothing.
For some bands, but I mean, there's a drummer I follow on YouTube, and they're like a hardcore metal band, and they're all sober.
Well, Straight Edge became a thing
too.
To be fair. But, like, I guess I'm just kind of railing in general against drugs. Like, I hope nobody in our audience is struggling with substance use disorder, because it is just, this is what it can lead to, this shit. And it's such a waste. Like, what a waste of a great talent. And not just a great talent. A human life.
Yeah.
And a dad.
And for the most part, it sounds like he was like a fun-loving kind of guy. And you can
yeah.
tell that, like, he's a big dude. Most big dudes I've met in my life are fun-loving type of guys.
Yeah.
I mean, they are. Because they're kind of big and they're trying not to harm anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Because they could pretty easily.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my experience with, like, as soon as you showed me a picture, I'm like, mm-hmm. he looks like a big dude.
Yeah, he was. Mm-hmm.
He's just, like, his frame. Mm-hmm. You don't have that frame unless you're, like, 6'3",
right.
like
yes.
220 pounds,
mm-hmm.
40 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, he kind of looks like a football player.
He does. He looks
like
an offensive lineman. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what he looks mm-hmm. like. So,
John Entwistle, another famous big guy who played,
mm-hmm.
He played bass, but also had drug problems.
Yep. Well, all these guys from this era. I mean,
yeah.
Jesus.
I mean, to Cetera's credit, he seems to be the first one to have sobered up.
Right. But think of Peter Cetera in the 80s as somebody that used to have a drug problem.
Yeah, right.
I mean, like, he had a whole image makeover and everything.
Yes.
You know.
I did think it might be kind of nice. There was a, he did some really nice vocal work. This is one of their more ballady songs, but it's not as
I'm listening. It is,
soft rock.
I just thought of something. I'm not going to play it, but I'm going to play it for you after, so.
This is Wishing You Were Here.
That's really cool.
It is a nice song, and Cetera's featured in it, but Terry sings the verses, and I thought we hadn't really heard his voice. He had a great voice, so this is his voice here.
Sounds a little Floyd influenced. Sounds a little Dave Gilmore.
Yeah. And Floyd, you're probably thinking because of How I Wish You Were Here.
A little bit, yeah. But also kind of the delivery.
His voice is very nice. It's kind of on the lower side. He could also really sing like bluesy.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a good voice. He had a good voice. So, yeah, it sucks that so many of these really talented musicians, and I mean, the list is literally endless. I mean,
the 27 Club starts in this era.
Yep. Well, the aforementioned Jimmy, we'll cover him one day. He's one of the ultimate 27 Club members. But, I mean, Amy Winehouse, like, really fucking talented people. I think it partially speaks to what I, like, my little theory that, like, if you excel at something, like, if your brain excels at something, there's
a serious deficiency somewhere
there's
else.
There's somewhere else it doesn't, you know? And, you know,
it's almost like just proven but not proven.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's, everybody kind of understands.
Like if
you're deaf, your eyesight's really good.
Right. If you're, something like that.
If you're blind, your hearing is really good.
Yeah.
And, you know.
Mm-hmm. But even just on a neurological level, I mean, that's something I feel I experience.
Sure.
I feel very competent and very good at some things. And then I'm just like, and yet, like, if you tell me, oh, did you see the such and such on your way home? No, because I can't observe a single thing. Like, I'm impossible of observation. I'm incapable of observation, you know. So I think that's kind of, and it's almost like, I always come to this for, you know, the famous people who died because of, like, drug issues or mental health issues. It's like, would it have been better if their artistry had just never been in the world, because then they could have just lived a nice little easy life.
Maybe. I mean, but if their artistry wasn't in the world, they would have done the same thing, but just as like a plumber.
Well, maybe.
Yeah.
But, you know, if we're talking about my brain theory about exceedingly talented in one area and then an issue somewhere else, like, it's almost like, what a privilege to be an average person, you know, sort of, or to be, like, unremarkable. There's a lot of beauty in unremarkableness, maybe, because it means, yeah, maybe you're not soaring to new heights, but you're not dropping to the abysmal lows that seem to come with it.
Yeah,
so,
right.
You know, there is that. Anyway, that was my little spiel.
There's a lot of bullshit that comes with fame. I think we can agree.
Well, there's that too. Abso-fucking-lutely. So, yeah. I think that's Demetrius telling us it's time.
Yeah, it's time to wrap it up and feed me. So, that was The Death of Terry Kath. This has been our 350th episode of All Bad Things. Thank you very much for our listeners that are sticking with us.
Yes. Just discovering us.
That too.
350 episodes in. You got a good back catalog.
We appreciate you very, very much.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And this has been another episode of All Bad Things. I'm David.
I'm Rachel.
We'll see you next week.